Next, James 4, 13 to 17. Page 1013 in your pew Bible. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. In 1848, Karl Marx laid out the 10 goals of the communist movement in the Communist Manifesto. And he said these were historically inevitable. They would most certainly come about. Just compare your checklist to the status of our own nation today. Number one, abolition of private property and the application of all property to public purposes. Number one, goal number one of the communist revolution. Second, a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. Thirdly, abolition of all rights of inheritance. And indeed, if the death tax goes through, that will be virtually what we're talking about. Number four, confiscation of the property of all emigrants and rebels. Emigrants, someone who is migrating out of the country. Number five, and of course, no offshore investments anymore, right? If we get our way. Number five, centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. Number six, centralization of the means of communication and transport in the hands of the state, i.e. state newspapers, state radio, television broadcasters, right? We have practically that now. Number seven, extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state. State-owned companies, in other words, like GM. Number eight, equal liability of all to work. The establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture, i.e. forced labor. Number nine, combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries. Gradual abolition of all distinction between town and country, by a more equitable distribution of the populace over the whole country. And of course, Chairman Mao did this in the Great Leap Forward. Many of you remember that from the 60s if you're a gray hair like me. And then finally, number 10, free education for all children in public schools. Sounds passé, doesn't it? Even in our own day. But these are the 10 goals of the Marxist Communist Party from the Communist Manifesto. And these goals, once again, as Marx would put it, are not thought to be more or less attainable, but rather they are held out as historical inevitabilities. One could be sure of the triumph of communism as the rising and the setting of the sun, as certain as the progression of the seasons. Marx says in the Communist Manifesto, the theoretical conclusions of the communist are in no way based on ideas or principles that have been invented or discovered by this or that would-be universal reformer. They merely express, in general terms, actual relations springing from an existing class struggle, from a historical movement going on under our very eyes, he says. From a historical movement going on under our very eyes, that is, the historic inevitability of the triumph of communism. And unlike Marxist communists in our own day who've changed their strategies and tactics to a Fabian strategy that is a gradual conquest, Marx and his ilk were not afraid to hide their goals and their motives. He concludes the Communist Manifesto with these words: the communists disdain to conceal their views and aims. They openly declare that their ends can be attained only by the forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions. Let the ruling classes tremble at a communistic revolution. The proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a world to win. Workers of the world, unite. Workers of the world, unite. I kind of like the dyslexic manifesto. Dyslexics of the world, untie. But since 1848, this has been the movement percolating throughout our world. Ever since then, there has been, seemed to be, an historical inevitability to communism that appeals to many, an inevitability of biblical proportions, really, literally, biblical proportions. In fact, it is a linear history intended to replace religion altogether. Religion, of course, disdained by the communists, the opiate of the people. Well, based on our text today, how do you think James would respond to Karl Marx? How would James respond to these assertions of historical inevitability for the triumph of communism? What would James say to a man who presumes to speak not only for his own individual history, but for all of human history? What can we say about a man who so confidently declares what the future will hold and does so without God altogether? Here James says, if the Lord wills, doesn't he? If the Lord wills, we will live and do this or do that. This, of course, would create immediate cognitive dissonance in the mind of Karl Marx, since he rejects God from history altogether. In the end, Karl Marx and his communist movement will be like the Wizard of Oz, a small man behind the curtain, manipulating levers, sounding loud and thunderous, but in the end, weak, vain, and finally no more able to affect the course of history than this poor, pathetic wizard was. So it will be with all presumptuous men, great or small. They boast, they arrogate, they strut, but like a mist, they come and go, remain for a while, and disappear. But God determines history, does he not? God providentially guides history and in the end determines that history as well. We know this from his text. We know this by comparing this text, do we not? But with redemptive history as it has been unfolding through the millennia. We see the triumph of God in history. All else is vanity, presumption, hubris. Presumption. That's the title of our message today. Let's look a little more carefully at what James says here and apply it not only to history broadly, but history more narrowly, i.e. your own personal lives. Presumption. There is some presumption going on, I dare say, in James's church, the churches to whom he is writing. That's our title today, presumption. He stands, James does, like a prophet this day, speaking against the presumption that, I dare say, has a tendency to creep and crawl into every man's heart. I know it does to mine. So, let's be upbraided a little bit, shall we? Brace yourselves. Sometimes we need a cup of cold water tossed in our face, don't we? Maybe so today. Verses 13 to 14, first of all, presumption. Stand rebuked, O believer, who knows better, whose arrogance presumes that he himself is master of his own destiny. It's been the problem from the Garden of Eden. Temptation dangled before Adam and Eve. You don't need to achieve those goals God set for you, taking dominion. You can take dominion without his way. You can do it my way. Here, let me show you. You can be master of your own destiny. Indeed. And that still rises up in our hearts, does it not? We are like our first father, Adam. Well, here, James is in the process of winding up his brief set of wisdom exhortations. He's becoming more and more pointed here. He's starting to go from preaching to meddling. He's a transition, you notice, from the congenial addresses like my brothers right? So you can, he's demarcated the different sections of his letter with these, my brothers now, right? My brothers here. Now, he's saying, come now, you. Next week, come now, you rich, weep and howl. Something seriously threatening to the community, which James feels necessitates increasing rebuke to the people. You'll see his language intensify these closing paragraphs as it does here. The Greek is not easy to capture. Age nun. It's meant to chasten and awake at the same time, and the ESV captures this pretty well. Come now, you who say. And there's some historical specificity here, too. There's a real situation percolating in the congregations which needs addressing. And once again, we refer you to our introduction, too, where we noted that at the time of the composition of James, the Christians of Jerusalem, Judea, and Galilee had been scattered by persecution into dispersion over all of Palestine. Historians like Josephus allude to wealthy landowners in the Christian community perishing in the siege of Jerusalem. That'll be applicable to what we treat next week, too, this very same historical background. And so James is now treating of these Christians, wealthy Christians dispersed over Palestine, treating of them in particular. They're the ones most likely to be in a position to, if we may say, go to New York City and Wall Street and make a fortune in the course of a year. These are ancient entrepreneurs, aggressive, confident capitalists who think that their investment judgment and skills cannot be denied. They'll make a fortune. They'll buy low and sell high. They'll see opportunity where others see only the doldrums. I like that kind of attitude. These are the kinds of men I want building businesses in the United States of America, with some qualifications, of course. These are the kinds of men who, when consciously practicing a philosophy of excess profit put back into investment, that I want creating wealth and therefore, thereafter, providing jobs. But there's something missing, isn't there? There's something missing, something empty in their language, something left out of the equation that James is rebuking. What is that missing element? What is that missing element? He puts some words to it. But it is faith, is it not? James will provide the words very soon. It will be the positive. But right now, he accentuates the negative, if you will. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring, do you? You say these things. You plan these things, but you still don't know what tomorrow will bring. It's lucky we've learned our lesson in the life of the church over the millennia, huh? And these are quaint words for history, and we don't need to really hear them anymore. We can study them historically and put them on a shelf and leave them there to sit, look at once in a while. I don't know about you, but in my own day-to-day experience, I need this wake-up call constantly. In my own day-to-day experience, it certainly seems like I know precisely what tomorrow will bring, sometimes to boring ends, you know? The sun will come up, Debbie will go out and milk her goats and collect her eggs, and my coffee maker will kick in at about 7 a.m. And after we live a few years, we establish ourselves and our families and our careers. It appears that we've achieved control over our life circumstances. Finally, some measure of control over my life circumstances. Right? We seek for that, don't we? Control. Oh, don't we know this? Some of us more than others. Control in our lives. Control over our lives. Control over others' lives. Us being controlled, perhaps. The illusion, anyway, oftentimes. I've seen it in counseling. Those with a severe trauma in their childhood, maybe they've been abused, sexually, physically abused, or maybe there's been tragedy in their lives, maybe the loss of a parent or a sibling. These young people, children with severe trauma, out of control themselves, you know, not in control of anything but being controlled as a child, severe trauma, often become obsessive later as they grow up, obsessive about control in their own lives, potentially destroying those lives, careers, families, relationships. It's that desire to master our life's circumstances that gets us in so much trouble, does it not? To make them increasingly predictable so we're not surprised by anything destructive or undesirable. This all often motivates us in what we do, makes us do what we do, strive for what we strive. But this is also what makes us human too, doesn't it? What we have done successfully as a species, too, with the same impulse that makes a squirrel store nuts for the winter or makes a bear eat voraciously to store fat for his winter hibernation. Only we have done so with our brains, such that we calculate that we can store wealth for our old age or food for 2 years, you know, while or when the system breaks down, you know, and then we, LDS, will emerge to govern the nations. You know, that's why they have those little pantries with 2 years' worth of food, because one of the days the system's going to break down and the LDS will survive and they'll emerge from the Holocaust to rule the world. It's that impulse, that squirreling away impulse, if you will, that drives hedge fund managers to buy and sell blocks of stock, what drove many of the skills of some of my elders and deacons who worked on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade back in the late 80s, early 90s when our family was living in that area. I remember visiting one of our elders on the floor as he traded pork bellies and grain futures in Chicago, on the Chicago Board of Trade. And he would give me a bit of the history and background of the institution. In the old days, on the floor of the exchange, you could literally smell the stockyards where all of those pigs and cattle were brought in by train from farms and ranches all over the Midwest into Chicago. Chicago. The yards. In the early days, they were about blocks away. And now, of course, you go there. It's exciting. You should go. They have tours. It's worth seeing if you're in Chicago for any length of time. Now, of course, the Chicago Board of Trade is housed in a skyscraper with mahogany paneled offices and expensive wine bars. And it smells not like pigs and cows, but like foo-foo cologne on men who patrol the hallways in silk suits instead of denim overalls. But the object is still the same. Predict the future of the market as best you can. Buy those pigs and cattle and grain at a price below what they'll eventually bring at the slaughterhouse or the grain mill. And the better you can do this, the more money you make. And you can make lots of money to doing this. Very heady stuff. Very heady stuff. As I walked about with my elder that day, very exciting. You can taste the adrenaline in the air. You can cut the tension with a knife. Some men are giddy with the success while others are in abject despair. Buyers and sellers compete to best the other, either buy low, sell high. Some men become fabulously wealthy and successful. Others, they ride high for a while and then they go bust. And others, very few, are kind of steady eddies. They go in for the long haul. They make a long and successful career of it. And there's not many of them. You get burnt out very quickly in this business. And the irony is always the same, though. The irony is always the same. There's always the unforeseen. There is always the unforeseen. The brightest with the best instincts can consider all the factors. What's the shape of the market? What's the weather? You know, I remember back in 92 when we had all the Midwest floods, destroyed so many pigs, cattle, and grain. What is Armour Meats going to do with their new CEO? What new regulations are coming out from the Agriculture Department? Sometimes inside information helps you buy for the future, too, or sell. And these best and brightest come out on top. But there's always the unforeseen. Oh, the undoing. The foil, the unforeseen. A blight that wipes out the wheat, perhaps, that year. A drought that reduces corn, even as it has this year. Maybe a glut of pork that drives down the price of pork bellies. And contemporarily, there's perhaps the artificially devalued Chinese yen. That means you have fewer dollars coming to you from that smiling, inscrutable Chinese official who just bought all your futures. The unforeseen. That circumstance that God uses, perhaps, to humble, to break, maybe to build up. There's an immense temptation to pride and arrogance in this field. It's hard to be successful, really, sometimes without being so. It almost comes with a job. You can literally become a millionaire overnight. Awash in money, suddenly. Promotions, you have the respect now of your peers, and maybe everyone in your congregation, too. Everyone suddenly, they seek your counsel, they follow you around, they buy and sell on your coattails, and you become then maybe a logical candidate for deacon, too, in the church, right? These things happen. So many of them boast in their arrogance, even those who identify themselves as Christians. There was a saying that floated around our staff at the church. Not a very flattering one either. It says, scratch a traitor anywhere and underneath you will find he is all donkey. Scratch a traitor, we had many traitors in our congregation, anywhere and underneath you will find he is all donkey. That's not quite the term that we use, donkey. I'll leave that to your imagination. I probably shouldn't say it here from the pulpit, but that's how they were characterized. But there was always the unforeseen, the thing that foil, that unforeseen circumstance that God uses to humble. And it breaks you if you're a donkey. The heart of what James says here, that is, you do not know what tomorrow will bring. You do not know what tomorrow will bring. And indeed, we say this many, many times, do we not? Not only on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade. I was just reminiscing about this with Deb here this morning. Bill Wilder was a 28-year-old trader in our congregation, Christ Church Lake Forest. He was bright and he was winsome. He was an up-and-comer. He had a lovely wife and two kids in a home in Winnetka. But one day in 1991, he fell dead of a heart attack while on the floor of the Board of Trade. No one saw it coming. He seemed to be in the pink of health. And it was a very sad funeral, too. A sad funeral for those reasons, but not like funerals of an unbeliever. He was one of those rare, humble, thoroughly converted traders. You scratched him, and underneath you didn't find a donkey. And I still remember this vividly as a young pastor too. It was instructed to me: you do not know what tomorrow will bring. You do not know what tomorrow will bring. Our life is in the end. What? Huh? Our life is in the end. What does your text say? Does it resonate with any Old Testament book, perhaps, that we looked at here recently? Your life is a mist. That's precisely how we translated that word in Ecclesiastes, hebel, right? As a mist or a vapor. Not vanity or meaninglessness, but brevity. Your life is but a mist. Vapor of vapors, says the preacher, vapor of vapors. All is vaporous. We're here but for a short moment like a vapor. We see the fog and the mist on Idaho waters all the time, don't we? Do we not? Especially this time of year. By the sun comes up and burns it all off, there it's gone. As intractable as it may have seemed at the moment. So James is on point here with Solomon. As Bill Wilder will testify in the eschaton, we are like Kohala's mist that appears for a little time and then it vanishes. Where is all boasting and arrogance then? Huh? Where is all boasting and arrogance? As certain and as proud, prideful and as inevitable as it may seem at the time, where is it? Huh? It is excluded, as Paul would say. Shame on us for doing so. Though it's the default setting for the human heart, isn't it? What should then be our response as growing Christians? We lapse, we struggle, sometimes we rise to great heights, and we are able to be ironically humble, are we not? But most of the time, this is our default setting as well, even as struggling Christians. What should be our response, though, as regenerate souls? We're now in the process of recalibrating our hearts so that we do not respond intuitively with pride and arrogance. And we're in the process of sanctification. We're being transformed from these lost donkeys, if you will, to regenerate sheep now. Well, he tells us in verses 15 to 17. Presumption. Presumption. Stand confident, O believer who now sees. He assumes that we now see. Even the changes and tenses of the verbs in Greek indicate that to us. Believer who now sees, whose humility now relies upon God's providence as master of his destiny. Not, you are not master of your own destiny, as proud and as equipped and as talented as you may be. And so in verses 15 to 17, James presents us here then with a stark contrast, as is the wont of wisdom writers. He says, instead, and that's a very strong word, anti. We get our word anti from this. That is, against what you've just heard, then, rather, instead what? Instead what? You ought to say, if the Lord wills. If the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. Okay. Now I got it. All I need to do is preface my otherwise boastful and arrogant statements with this, and I'll be sanctified, right? If the Lord wills, I will go and build a house with substandard materials and make more than I would have otherwise. If the Lord wills, I will cut the knees out from my colleagues and get that NFL account in my portfolio, whatever it takes. If the Lord wills, I will lie, cheat, and steal in order to become president of the United States. Couldn't resist, sorry. Is this what James is asserting? Is this phrase provided for us a kind of verbal talisman? A kind of good luck charm we can wear around our necks and have God in our back pocket? You see, pagan religions have these kinds of things all the time in their bag of tricks, if you will. This is how their unregenerate man operates and thinks. He can do no other. We hear this phrase pass the lips from hypocrites in Christianity all the time, don't we? We hear it in Judaism, too. The Lord of hosts willing. And in Islam, Allah, the merciful willing. By doing these things with these words coming from our mouths, they bring reproach to the name of Christ. So this is not what James is saying. These are not verbal talismans. This is a matter of heart conviction. A matter of heart conviction that you must know and believe and act upon. The Lord willing. We know that over all stands a God of providence, don't we? Our shorter catechism says God's works of providence are his most holy, wise, and powerful, preserving and governing all his creatures. Includes you, includes me. His powerful, preserving, and governing all his creatures and all their actions. This is a matter of conviction. We should know these things, believe these things, act on these things to our toenails, right? I was at Bill Wilder's funeral. I know from conviction that my life is a mist. And that only if the Lord is willing as he governs me and my actions will I, like Bill intended, to buy and sell and trade, raise my family, pay off my mortgage. If the Lord wills. I was at Bill Wilder's funeral. I was at my mother's funeral. I know from conviction that my life is a mist. And that only if the Lord is willing, as He governs me in my actions, will I, like my father always assumed that he would do, to plan and prepare for my dying long before my wife. My father always told us to prepare for your family. He was prepared to die first, thought he would. It was a pattern in his family, it would be the pattern in his too. But no, he lived 15 years beyond my mom. If the Lord wills, I too will plan and prepare for my dying before my wife. Anything suspicious happens, I just want you guys, okay? You guys to take note, okay? I love you, sweetheart. I know you love me. I also personally conducted my brother's funeral. Some of you remember those days. I know from conviction to my toenails that my life is a mist. And that only if the Lord is willing, as He governs me and my actions, will I take a vacation in the future. That year, we were going to take a vacation into Glacier National Park with my family. I intended to do that in the summer of 2003. If the Lord is willing, cut short with the death of my brother, 2003. Do you know these things? I'm sure if we were to talk and if you were to give some examples, you have these flowing from your lives as well. And indeed, if the Lord has regenerated your heart, if you are a new creature in Christ, then you have some semblance of humility towards these things, do you not? I urge you to cultivate these things, to see the world as James is presenting it here for you. Anything else is hubris. Humility teaches us that all of our plans and our preparations, and this doesn't excuse us either from doing so, too. Just parenthetically, it doesn't excuse us because we have to say, who knows what the future will bring? What's around the corner? It does not excuse us from planning either. We are intended to do so. All the rest of Scripture testifies to that, doesn't it? We saw that all through the book of Ecclesiastes. So we're not excusing planning and preparation. But we must do so always knowing all of this must be tempered with that to the toenails conviction that a sovereign God who governs and disposes the destinies of His creatures, that He may intervene at any time with another outcome. Are you ready for that? And it isn't always pleasant, is it? And we can look outside and I can look upon each one of you and see how God is doing that in some of your destinies. I wouldn't want to be going through some of the things you're going through. And I'm sure there'll be things in my life, too, that will make the ears of those who hear it tingle, if you will. But we must always acknowledge what our confession, what the Scriptures acknowledge, too, that His disposition of our destinies is most holy, most wise, and most powerful. It is a most holy, wise, and powerful providence that governs your life, dear listener. Unlike our profane, foolish, and impotent tyranny over our lives, which is what it is in the end, isn't it? Is it not? If we resolve all of this to ourselves, if we think we are masters of our own destiny, if we think we are gods in our lives, so we must know that our destiny is indeed tempered, that a sovereign God who governs and disposes our destiny is most holy, wise, and powerful, and He may intervene with another outcome unforeseen by us. Are you ready for that? Maybe you haven't been in the past. Keep practicing. Keep practicing because God's providence is sovereign and powerful overall. Anything else is just hubris. All speech otherwise is boasting in arrogance. James calls it for what it is. All such boasting is evil, he says. Okay. You're now enlightened. You are now enlightened. You know more of what you must do. And if you don't do it, then it is not of faith, is it? You know what it is you must do. You must be industrious and productive. You must fulfill the creation mandate. You must plan. You must prepare. Be fruitful and multiply, we are commanded. Fill the earth, subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. You are responsible for doing this. You are a regenerate soul now who is, of all men, more equipped and prepared to do this. You do it on your king's behalf as a vice-regent of the Creator and Savior who issued this command. You may trade on the Chicago Board of Trade like my elder in Lake Forest. You may build homes. You may program fountains. You may measure heat tolerances as Dean does in rockets. Maybe you enable those with disabilities to become productive citizens like Ken. But we are all charged with taking dominion over God's bequeathal to us. And as such, we must plan and husband our resources carefully, using the gifts that He has given us as vice regents. But, oh, there is always that devilish, satanic tendency to say we will do it our way, not the way given us in the garden, but the way the serpent presented it to us. Another way, my way, take dominion for myself and in my own way. As we meet success after success, God warned the Israelites in Deuteronomy, did He not? As we meet success after success and we prosper, we're masters of our own destinies apart from God, as Marx would put it, from a historical movement going on under our very eyes. Rather, know that your particular plans will succeed, and they will proceed if the Lord wills. And that in the end, He will triumph. God will triumph. As He says in Revelation, He who was seated on the throne said, "Behold, I am making all things new." Also, He said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." And He said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega." It is done. That's power. That's potency. It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. This is holy, wise, and potent will, and it will be done as we pray, right? This is certainty, true historical inevitability. This is why we must temper all of our lives with the knowledge and the awareness that in the very act of living, an all-wise, all-loving God of providence is personally, lovingly guiding us each step of the way. Such that He will say on that day when all of our labors will come to full fruition as those vice-regents of our Creator. And we see that though we did not always personally agree with His providence, maybe discomfited from time to time because of that providence, we may not have thought it good in our own minds. Nevertheless, He will say to each one of us, as He said to John, "It is done. It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son." Precious is that promise. Trust His providence, dear brothers and sisters. Trust His providence. Dear sons of the living God, may you thrive and prosper in your week coming and take dominion, if the Lord wills. Let us now come to that place where dominion has been asserted by our God, in that He has promised us grace in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.